When someone we love dies young, how to understand it in a way that really helps. Death is remember, most of us now, most all of us, are not dead yet. Most of us are. So that we don't know what it is in terms of experience. We can't remember. I don't know, maybe some people can remember the previous life death, but I can't. So death of the body is something that is in the future. And so we contemplate that death is what we don't know. Don't know. That the word death itself when you contemplate it, is don't know. I mean, you might have theories or beliefs about it, you know, that about reincarnation or going to heaven or hell or oblivion. You might, you know, once you're dead, there's nothing, or you go to hell, or you go to paradise, you go to heaven, you get reborn, you reincarnated as a fish or a alligator, or maybe there's certain groups that believe that we can never go backward, we can never be reborn as a lower form, so we maybe get reborn as a human being or as a devata. But tell us this right now, I don't know. as an experience now, because this is life, this is living, body's alive, consciousness is like this. The body, a living body's like this. And so we acknowledge, we notice the way it is. And that in terms of the death of somebody else, is that now we perceive that person as dead rather than alive. So the perception, that means we don't know. If they're alive, and they're sick, or they're happy, or they're depressed, or they're insane, or they're young or old, or whatever, we can kind of understand all of that. Because we experience all those states. But death is, we don't know. So, when you hear somebody's alive, that's one, you know, something in you can relate to life because you're experiencing it. And then, when somebody's dead, then it's a different feeling. You don't know. So there's a gap. What I might describe is like a gap or a space. When somebody dies, it leaves like a gap in the mind, a space. Death is what we don't know. And so when somebody dies young, it's usually like death of an old person is more, seems natural, and you know, when you get old, you die, and so there's a kind of resignation to that, and more accept. Sometimes that's easy to accept, the death of an old person, but especially somebody young, we find that, you know, because we still perceive youth as living and not as dead, and there's a kind of maybe an emotional feeling of whatever you're feeling, you know, notice that. The confusion around it, or the grief, or the indignation, or whatever at this moment you happen to, the feeling, the emotion that you have. But this is a reflection on death. from the position of the here and now in terms of our own experience. So it helps, as I say, how to understand it is in a way that it really helps. This to me helps, you know, a way of accepting it. Because what can we do about it? It's the way it is. If we hate it, resent it, then we, you know, this just creates suffering for us around something that is perfectly natural. Death, when you're born, then you can die at any time after you're born. You know, you can, as soon as you're born, you could, the body can die. I mean, death isn't a matter of living to 95 and then dying, but it can happen at any moment, physical death. And so when young people die, there's a kind of sadness to that, because we'd like to think of the young, you know, growing up and getting old and living their lives fully rather than dying young. But also, people die young. There's these beautiful poems by this Gitanjali, this Indian girl that died when she was only 14 years old of cancer. It's called Songs of Gitanjali. And she kept a diary, or wrote a lot of poetry. She's a very good poet in English, and she lived in India, and she hid these poems. Nobody knew, her mother found them after she died, and she kind of tucked them away in secret corners of a room in the mattress or whatever, and finally, the mother finally found these poems, and they've been published in a book. Quite moving, but this young girl, Indian girl, is talks about death in a very mature way. It's amazing. This, even though she's only about 13 years old or so, somehow you feel it's a kind of sadness that she dies young, but you also feel that she seemed to understand everything quite well. Maybe it was not necessary to live any longer. I don't know, I'm speculating. But according to the poems, she seemed to be someone that it wasn't a tragedy in the sense of she died in a state of unfulfilled youth and completely bewildered and depressed and miserable by the fact that she was dying, but it seemed to be, you know, she seemed to be very, very wise and about what was happening to her, because it took several years for her to die, and the kind of degeneration, and then the concern she had about how her mother felt or her father. And a lot of the poems about the sadness she felt when her father came into the room, not because he was so upset by what was happening to her. That's quite mature. When you're the one who's dying, so we don't know, you know, whether, you know, is physical age the determination? Some people are quite wise when they're very young. Some people are still very foolish when they're 95. So then is it the quality of life or the length of life that's important? You know, this is where, you know, to me it's more important. I'd rather live a short life in a wise way than a long one in a stupid way. But this not knowing, I mean, this is very, you know, death, the end, the future, the darkness, the unconditioned, all these things point to not knowing, but not to a stupidity, but a realization. It's not knowing as an act of stupidity, but it's not knowing as a realization. There's a difference, isn't there? This not knowing when you realize that, then you find peace with it. It takes you to peace and emptiness and silence, rather than to, you know, a black hole of misery. Or, I mean, we create the misery around the fact that we don't know, or we're frightened by the fact that death, because we don't understand death, that we merely get frightened by it, or we just react in emotional ways or we just feel totally confused or upset when somebody dies young because it's not fair and we think it's abnormal or it's not right. Or we think of it as depressing or bad or whatever. But when we really look at it in terms of experience, what is the result? There's a difference, isn't it? Like I noticed with Ajahn Chah, when he was ill for 10 years, seriously ill for 10 years before he died, where he was incapacitated and couldn't speak and had to be taken care of. He couldn't move and they had to feed him and do everything for him for 10 years. But he was alive, his body was breathing, he was conscious. So because he couldn't talk or he didn't, and sometimes he seemed to, you know, people oftentimes assumed that he didn't know what was going on. They thought maybe he was like a vegetable, but he wasn't. He was aware, and when he was interested, he would, you know, he's obviously very much aware of what you were. When I would go and visit him, until the last time I saw him, he was unconscious. But before that, he was always very aware of me, and I would talk to him and tell him what was happening here in England and what was happening with the monks and so forth. And he would, you know, there was a, you know, he could look at me with his eyes, and there was certainly, you know, he wasn't a cabbage or anything. Certainly. With me, and there with through the eyes you could tell him that sometimes I think if he just didn't want to be bothered, he would just close his eyes. But then he was still alive, his body was still alive, and that. But when he died, and we thought he could die any time, you know, during those 10 years. So sometimes they'd phone me when it was a crisis. They'd phone me from Thailand. They'd say, "Ajahn Chah is in the emergency unit in the hospital. We think he's going to die." And at first, you know, I'd get I'd almost, you know, get on the first flight out of Heathrow off to Bangkok. And then he'd pull through, so that this was the idea that he's going to die, and we were all prepared, you know. Intellectually, we knew that he was going to die, and he could die at any time. So, intellectually, up here, you knew that it was, and that wasn't a shock. But how you felt emotionally was a different way. And then, when he did die, then the perception of Ajahn Chah is dead. And then Ajahn Chah is dead. I felt this grief, a grief, the sense of grief, of loss, emotional. It was emotional. It wasn't intellectual. Now it's quite intellectual. I was prepared for it. It wasn't a surprise, or, you know, but it. But you can't, but I couldn't feel that kind of grief till actually, you know, the word came, Ajahn Chah is dead. Even if Ajahn Chah is in the ICU, or it's a critical thing, but then the word death is a very powerful word. And or when I went to see Master Hua, I'd contemplate, Master Hua is dead, and I'd feel this grief. A sense, it's a loss, an emotional feeling of loss, is how I describe it. And death, and just, even if somebody told me Ajahn Chah was dead and he wasn't, I'd still feel it. You can feel it in a cinema. When you absorb into the movies and somebody dies, you feel their grief. Not yet. I do. Even though it's, you know, it's a movie, shadows on the screen. And, you know, it's an actor's, playing roles. But that particular, that's an emotion that we have is grief. Which doesn't mean it's even happened, you know, that, I mean, the actors are, you know, they're not dead. But it's that whole kind of set of that we have. I mean, I'm just observing this. I'm not, from my own experience, how it works. Or if somebody's dead, but you think they're still alive, you don't feel grief. So, just the word death, it brings that up sometimes. Or a cat, your cat dies. Or the goldfish. And just to contemplate, you know, as you watch your heart, your heart, like here, bring attention more to this part of your body, you know, like, you can use the body as an object. So, like, when we're talking about watching the heart, actually, bring your attention actually to this part. So you can kind of, where you feel, or in the solar plexus, in this, the trunk here, is where you feel your emotions. So that you can, you use it as an anchor, just to kind of get in touch with feeling and the emotional world that you can dismiss just through the intellect. If you know, you just endlessly think about it and rationalize it out is one way. But then the emotional reaction can be, you can not notice it. I was telling one of the monks today about when Ajahn Bhupakaro disrobed. And some of you knew Ajahn Bhupakaro, and he disrobed about 5 years ago, I think. And he and I had been monks together for 20 years or so in Thailand, been through all kinds of things, and it was a good thing he was disrobing. I mean, intellectually, I was all for it. He was making a mess of monastic life, and he obviously, had reached the limits of it, and it was apparent that this was a good move to disrobe. So it was up here. It was, you know, I was all for it intellectually, and then the day came for him to disrobe. And I remember, that night when I went to bed, I said, tomorrow he's going to disrobe, that's quite acceptable, no particular emotion arose. And then the morning, I woke up, and then the thought came to me, Ajahn Bhupakaro is going to disrobe. And then this incredible grief came over me. I sat there in my bed, and the tears pouring down, And I don't know why, because intellectually I think he's going to disrobe, that's fine, you know, fine with me, good idea. And yet on the heart level, it was grief. You know, it was very strange for me, because you know, you give so much emphasis to your rational mind, and you believe it is the you believe in it so much and give it a priority. But yet on the, you know, even though it was all rationally acceptable and a good thing, emotionally, the disrobing is like a law, like a death for a monk. So, because in the monastic life, there's a great kind of bond that you have with other monks, especially if you've been with each other for a long time. Sometimes you don't realize it till they disrobe. So then, I'm the one that had to disrobe Ajahn Prabhakara. This thing's like, I can't do it. I'm gonna ask Ajahn Sujito to do it. any monk can disrobe another monk. I don't have to do it. I was going to back out, but I knew that you know, I was chicken. Didn't want to have to face it. So instead, I couldn't get up and go out. And so somebody came to see me, and I said, "Would you tell Ajahn Prabhakara that I can't disrobe him yet? Wait till tomorrow." And so the next day, and that day I felt a lot of grief, but the next day it was kind of finished, and he came, and I disrobed him, and so forth. But that day there was a genuine emotional grief that wasn't sentimentally, it wasn't a sentiment of the mind, you know, like watching a movie where you're getting caught up in an illusion, but it was a human experience of grief, of loss of a brother monk. And then after that, then it was all right, you know. Grief is something you get over. It's not like, you know, it wasn't depressing or it wasn't shattering or disturbing, but it was something, you know, that you have as a human being. It's a natural feeling. Not to mention when it's, you know, like your mother or father or somebody, you know, you have very strong connections to through ancestry, and a very, you know, brought you up and so forth. But also it's interesting in Sangha how that happens. But it is the ending of something. Like disrobing is like the ending of it. The relationship changes, and the Sangha is quite a powerful experience. That sometimes you don't realize while you're in it the strength of it. And then when somebody leaves it, then you have this experience of grief. But how many of you, you know, and sometimes we in the society we feel we don't, you know, we can dismiss it. You know, grief is something that can be just ignored, and then it seems to, you know, then it's something, you know, it's held in the body in some way, or some way affects life, so that people get depressed, or men especially, I think, you know, get depressed as they get older, because probably a whole, you know, unrecognized grief experience has never been resolved, because there's a lot of grief, which you may not notice. Just like your cat dying. Intellectually, you say it's only a cat. But yet, you know, there's the end of something you might have loved very much and strong connection to. or disappointments in life, and that we all have our disappointments, disillusionments with things, and these are not processed, then they still, you know, if you don't resolve them, then they, as life goes, as you live your life, then they tend to, you know, it seems to have a cumulative effect that maybe bring us a nervous breakdown or something, you know, in the midlife, or even when we're young, people have breakdowns because maybe of unresolved emotions. And because the society we live in tends to be so, you know, is full of ideas and you know, and a kind of dismissal of emotional experience, as if it were, you know, something that you don't want to be bothered with. But yet, when we look at life, it's an emotional experience. It's all sensitivity. Always feeling all the time. Just look when you can feel it inside here. When somebody looks at you in a certain way, that looks angry at you, they can look angry at you. Maybe they're not even angry at you, but they look angry, and you pick it up. You can feel it here, right in your body. What's that about? Is that because you're neurotic and super sensitive, oversensitive and delicate? Or is that just the way it is? Life is, you know, in this realm is a sense realm. And so we feel, and that feeling is sometimes very, can be, we cut ourselves off with by say, thinking too much. As I say, when you think too much, get caught in ideas, then the sensitivity is cut. You aren't aware of the sensitive experience of consciousness. You're working always from ideas that are not sensitive conditions, are they? Think of it, have an idea and see if it's sensitive. It's not, and so if you just think, then you can get caught in ideas alone, and views and opinions, and that, then it doesn't mean you're not sensitive, but you're out of touch with it. You can suppress or ignore it, much of it, till it kind of explodes out on you when you've had enough. Or they say, like in childhood, just the traumas of childhood, the feeling of being rejected by the group, or the having to, the first going to school and all the traumas of having to go to school and leave your mother as she takes you to school. And you have to go into this strange place and all these other little boys start picking on you. And your mother goes away. I mean, you can think, well, you know, that's everybody has, but still, these are, you know, over a lifetime can be accumulated grief experiences that say, in meditation sometimes we're now being able to, you know, they come up, or we suddenly feel maybe emotions that we don't understand because they aren't related to anything we're thinking in the moment. And then we might think, you know, that it's, we're going crazy or whatever. but you're not, it's to see it in the right way. And that's also like a purification, a resolution of karma that is necessary for spiritual development and just health, good health and a happy life in the worldly sense. Then this other question, Could you say something about the nature of dunha, desire, and explain how it differs from other kinds of desire? Raga, which is desiring things you like, dosa, desiring to be rid of things you don't like, and lopa, covetousness, greed. And can you explain why the Buddha said and was said was dunha and not these other kinds of desire that is the cause of suffering? So, I mean, these are, dunha is a kind of generic term. So it just points to that experience of wanting something, or the wanting or not wanting. And then raga is a desiring things you like, you know, like gama dunha, seeing something and wanting it. So in Thai, raga often means lust, sexual desire. Then the dosa means aversion, anger and hatred, so that when we see something we don't like, then we want to get rid of it. So that points to different kinds of, you know, of experiences. But dunha itself is the generic term for desire. Dunha and dukkha, you can use interchangeably. There is dunha. Dunha has causes, and there's a cessation of dunha. And there's a way, and there is the way of living where there's no dunha. You can use it like that, or dukkha, suffering, or desire. But desire, again, is something to know, to examine. Because it's so much a part of our experience that if people say, Buddhists believe you shouldn't have any desires, you shouldn't desire anything. I mean, that's impossible, isn't it? None of us can be Buddhists then. Because this is a desire realm. You know, this body is desire body, desires things. And so, you know, when you're eating food, if your body's hungry, it needs food, doesn't it? So you're looking at food, say, and you're hungry, you're naturally, it's not just greed for, you know, just distract, eating through to distract your mind, but you're really, you're feeling hungry, the body needs food. You're looking at the food and you feel this desire for the food. And then what do? You say, oh, I'm full of desire. Greed. Because this food is looking very attractive and you want to go and put it into your mouth. And then you take it in a personal way. You think, I'm a greedy person. I can never be enlightened because I'm so greedy. And Buddhists shouldn't have any desires. We shouldn't have any desire for food. Buddhist monks. So I've seen, you know, some Western monks feel so guilty about any form of greed. They think it's all bad that they'll try to, you know, they become anorexics or whatever. Refuse to eat. So. But that, there's no wisdom there. Why do we make everything so personal? The body needs food, and so that there's this, you know, the food is there, and you're feeding the body. Why do you have to make it into I'm greedy? Because you don't know how to, you know, you've not contemplated the nature of desire, and how it works. You're merely taking a stand that desire and greed is somehow bad, and you shouldn't have it. But when you're contemplating the way it is, this body is a desire body, so that's its nature. But that which is aware you know, that mindfulness, sati sampajanya, aware of greed. Greed is an object, and desire is an object. So you can. That's not what you are. It's a something that you're experiencing, but no longer seen in terms of me and mine. So you begin to get the right relationship to the needs of your body, to the world you're living in. Which doesn't, like the Buddha still ate food after enlightenment. Monks and nuns, we're celibate, but we're still allowed to eat food. Why? Because you can live without sex, but you can't live without food. You know, we aren't going to die because we don't have sex. But we will if we don't have food. The food is, you know, like when we ordain, then we're given an alms bowl and say, this food is necessary. So you're given an alms bowl to get the food. Sexual desire is in the Western world is made into a very personal thing. You know, it's all fraught with me and mine. Where it's a natural kind of instinctual desire. You know, it's nature, and yet we make it into, either we're very guilty about it, we feel it's dirty, or, you know, if you're a puritanical type of person, you feel it's, somehow it's bad or dirty, or you exalt it, make it into, you know, the ultimate human happiness. The best that life has to offer, or you make it into, that's the only thing worth living for is sex, or you can see it only in terms of, as a something that you've got to resist and control and suppress, or you can just follow, you know, whatever. Whenever you feel that desire, you just follow it. And these are different attitudes we have about, you know, we have various, if we don't have any sexual desire, we get worried. And if we have it, we get worried. And if we have too much of it, and there's all kinds of books, and it's always an interesting subject. You can always, if you have the word sex, that's a word that grabs your attention, doesn't it? Sex. Because it's interesting and exciting. Anything sexual, you know, is interests us and excites us. So this is the way it is, because it is a strong and very powerful energy that we have through the body, that it's very natural. There's nothing wrong with it, it's not a matter of thinking that you shouldn't have it, but it's to understand it. Because this energy, you say, if misused, leads to all kinds of difficulties. We can see, like, because of promiscuity and just a seeking, using sex as just a kind of high, get pleasure out of it. You can become obsessed with it or fixated on it and so forth. It can be a very addictive to just have that pleasure some kind of sexual release. So, in in meditation, we're noting this desire, not judging it. And the more we understand it, then we like celibate life is a good reflection for it, because we have no way of following it in any intentional way. So, you know, because all forms of sexual activity with anybody, or just through our own efforts, masturbation, things like that, are totally forbidden. So you're having to deal with this energy in a way that understanding it rather than just trying to deny it or reject it or control it through repression. So then, you begin to develop an awareness around the forces, the powerful energies of the body, because the body is not self, and sexual desire is something, is an object you can look at. It's not something you are, not really yours. So you have you begin to see it in a different way than when you're identifying with, I have a strong sex drive, or I'm, you know, the way we can make it into a highly personal problem or attribute. So that this is, and so saying, celibacy is the value of it, say, in monastic life, is that it mirrors this strong drive of the body, and the attraction that you feel, and the forces of nature, like the natural attractions between male and female. They're just, you know, they're that way. It's not even personal in the sense of me and you, but it's a natural kind of, the body is attracted in that way. Bodies are attracted to each other. So that's why we have these rules, you know, about not touching women, and that not because of there's anything wrong with women, but because touching women tend to stimulate that desire in men, in the body, that you can feel your body in proximity to a woman's body. Sometimes it gets very, you know, even if you have no intention or no thoughts in your mind, the body knows. It's got its own communication. And then you may be, you know, that's what you don't want at all. You're trying to be a pure celibate monk, and the body has its own, you know, that's its natural inclination. So I mean, it's so like hugging and kissing and touching and patting, and all these would tend to get us into a lot of trouble if we're trying to be celibate. But the celibacy itself is not to be repressive or in terms of denial or rejection of it, but to understand it, to be able to integrate that energy. Because it's like you're raising up the energy. Because the sexual energy tends to be in the genital area. So I mean, if we don't, you know, if that's all we ever, if we just use some form of sexual release, then we become obsessed just on that level alone. So that the aim of celibacy is to bring or restraint of some sort, you know, for lay people to not just use sex as it becomes a habit, or promiscuous, or just using it for personal pleasure, and just playing with it and misusing it. Because then your spiritual life can't develop at all. Because you need that energy to bring it up into the heart. We need to integrate that energy into the body. So like celibate life tends to, if the problem is the energies tend to integrate into the whole body. You feel a sense of fullness of your body. It's like it's filled with this energy. As a complete kind of integrated thing, rather than seeing celibacy as merely a kind of desperate attempt to deny and get rid of the energy.
In some traditions, I think in Japan, for example, where there are a lot of monks who do get married, would you say that they don't develop awareness around that then apparent in the same way? Or would you say that they could use the sexual experience to develop the awareness if they're sexual things?
Right. I mean, you have to, what you choose, you have to use that. Like if you're celibate, and then you have sexual relationships, it doesn't work. But marriage, then the relationship should be on a basis of Dhamma rather than on just exploiting each other for pleasure and misuse of. I mean, it's how you relate to it. Because sexuality itself is no problem. It's how we, celibacy is probably, is one way of dealing with it. You hear about couples developing spiritually, they tend to be increasingly more celibate as life goes on. I mean, because that experience of life no longer is something that is very attractive to you. And if you're contemplating Dhamma,
Well,
it is a real, I admire, like somebody like Ajahn Chah never had sexual experience. I think he was ordained when he was about 12 or something. And yet he was wise. But he understood it. Because he had the ability to understand things through his own experience without having to go through experiences. He could extrapolate just from the nature of desire, what from the desires maybe that you have, or other desires, and that to be able to infer from that what the rest are like. But that's quite that's rare. Most of us have to find out, and then after a while we begin to we see the pointlessness of it. the result oftentimes if misuse of sexuality it leads to a kind of self-loathing or you don't like yourself very much if that's your main interest in life, something in you, is feels unworthy. So, let me think about it. I mean, the body or the...
Yeah.
No, but there can be in the experience of sex, there can be desirelessness.
Right. The body has the natural attractions, but the
it's not wanting anything.
Yeah.
No wanting anymore. It is possible. And I would suggest that, you know, that it's something to, you know, be mindful of, as far as any sexual relation.
Yes, I can't speak for a period of that. Because my sex life was really much desire
oriented. But I said it can be kind of spiritual experience too, you know, enhancing in the spirit rather than just gratifying in sexual terms.
Well, I'm sure it can, you know, just in terms of how you, you know, what you're, you know, if you're thinking of, I mean, the like promiscuity, how I use that word is, or misuse of sex is where you're just seeking gratification for yourself. You're exploiting somebody else for your own thrills or needs. And that's unwholesome to do. Or just using your body, you know, like say in masturbation, things like that, just to get exciting experiences. But you know, but the sexual act is also a religious symbol. You know, it can be a spiritual symbol. As a, you know, as a union, for union and wholeness. So that's why you can use that is symbolic for the religious symbol for spiritual union. And I noticed, like in India, going to the Kali temple in Calcutta, I remember, there they have all these Shiva lingams, these palaces of Shiva, and their whole kind of field of them, and Hindu women come and put garlands on them and oil and things like this, and you can tell it's a devotional thing, and it's not, you know, it's filled with a religious attitude. And yet I noticed how my mind is conditioned to see it in pornographic terms. You know, almost like, you know, the Western way of conditioning sees the phallus only in terms of kind of pornographic way. And so, you know, one could kind of snicker at these women putting garlands on these phalluses.
Is it a fertility?
Yeah. But also, it's as far as the Shiva Lingam goes, it's a, and that whole Mother Kali cult, it's more than fertility. You know, it's a respect for nature. And of course, Kali is a very bewildering symbol to the Western mind, because she's the most horrendous looking female you ever see. You know, really terrifying. But Kali also means time, you know. So that, you know, time is that way. It gives birth and then it consumes its own children, Mother Time. So these are just human, ways of using symbolism to try to contemplate or to bring into consciousness a way of looking at life that is, you know, for the spiritual because that spiritual aspiration is there, and these things are affecting, you know, are affecting our conscious experience, the body, its functions, its energies, its habits, mental habits, and so forth. Then, also, if you have time, could you say something about why it is that some of the most enlightened people this century have been so strongly against the practice of Buddhism? I am thinking particularly of people like Jay Krishnamurti and Sri Aurobindo. They didn't sign their name on this. But whether, you know, like Krishnamurti, he was a funny one, because he kind of gave mixed messages all the time. I think what he generally meant was he saw religion only as kind of conforming to beliefs and institutions. I remember once going to a talk in Brockwood Park years ago when he was alive, and he was making fun of monks. You know, everybody was looking at us, saying they were all, you know, attached and stupid and they didn't know what they were doing. And he saw us sitting there, and all these people started, okay. He seemed to have this idea that people, that you were attached to views about God, or that your life was one where you were just hoping that shaving your head, wearing a orange robe, and following rules and that would enlighten you. And of course he knew that wasn't the way it works. And then his own experience of life was a kind of rebellion against organized religion, from his experience with the Theosophical Society and all the kind of silliness that goes on in religious circles. So there is, you know, you can certainly, religion, any religious tradition, you can use it for the wrong things. You know, you can, if you attach to ideas about Buddhism, then you become a Buddhist, but you may never get enlightened. Or any other religion, if you just, you know, if you just conform to it and go along with it, then you may, you know, it may be good in a way. You start being maybe a better person or a happier person, but because you have a love of something good or something that you believe in, but wouldn't necessarily enlighten you till you use it in the right way, which is not through clinging or belief, but through understanding. How can you use convention for mindfulness, in other words, in Buddhist terms? You know, how do we use our monastic life it's helping us to be mindful, rather than just institutionalized into monastic rules and tradition. So this is the challenge we have, you know, how to use the robes, the ceremonies, the imagery, the tradition that we have, say, from Thailand, how to use it for mindfulness rather than for conditioning. So in terms of, like, if we become Buddhist, then we tend to adopt Buddhist things, like we wear Buddhist clothes and we use Buddhist words and we perform Buddhist ceremonies. But it doesn't mean that we ever gain enlightenment. But like with meditation, then you're really examining, like the rules of tradition then are things to operate from, to bring into consciousness, so that they're reminders, they're helpers on the path, to their standards or their criteria for action and speech and for reflection on what's happening. And it's interesting with this question about God. Where does God tie into the religious life experience? And because God is a word that, you know, it's an English word, so, and then the general attitude is that Buddhists, we don't have any God. And many of us were attracted to Buddhism because there isn't any God. Because our perception of God maybe wasn't a very good one, so we thought we'd just get rid of God, and Buddhism doesn't have God in the way that we might have used the word. And so, you know, but then as you're meditating, you're contemplating Dhamma, the word God is a part of one's cultural conditioning, whether you like it or not. You know, I wasn't brought up in a Buddhist family, I was brought up in a Christian family, so God is a word that's a part of a cultural experience. And so therefore, you can look at it in just maybe the biased ways that you've acquired it, you know, or rebelled against it, or just see it in the most simplistic terms of, you know, like this Jewish terrorist that killed Mr. Rabin last week, and he said God told him to do it. Then they asked him, he said, is this a plot of Jewish fanatics to, and he said, no, just me and God. God told me to do it. No, you know, what can you say about that? You know, I'm sure the Palestinian, the Muslims, and God tells them different things too, to kill Jewish fanatics. You know, and then you realize God is a pretty dodgy word. You know, what do you mean by it? Then you go to interfaith meetings and they say, do you believe in God? What do you mean by God? And they say, you should, God, you know, God. But I mean, when you get down to it, people have all different views about what God is. You know, it's a word, it's only a word. So, and then it's pointing to, what do you mean? If a Jewish terrorist says God told him to kill Mr. Rabin, then God must be, you know, something in his head. Because I'm sure, you know, most other people that God speaks to, he wasn't telling them that. You know, so I mean, in the States in the old days, before the civil rights movement, and they had a lot of racial segregation in the American South. And the white people in the South used to say, God doesn't want the races to mix. He wants apartheid. He wants black people to go to black churches and white people to go to white churches. They say, well, aren't black people just as much God's children? Yes, we're all equal under God. But God wants black people. He doesn't want the races to mix. And that's why he made them black and white. And then you say, but he didn't do a very good job, because they're attracted to each other, and they can intermarry, and they can produce children. You know, if God had anything on the ball, he would have made it so, you know, like, there's no attraction there, or there's no way you could reproduce, so. I mean, but that's how the mind, you know, is. God becomes a racist or a Jewish fanatic. I mean, so the, but then, and then God as a man, as a father, as a male figure, and so women now question, why does God have to be male? That's a good question. And these are, you know, these are things that stimulate the mind and make us question a lot of things we take for granted. So the whole subject of God needs to be, you know, in our experience now, say in practice. You know, if God is in Christianity, God is a creator God too. So God created everything. In Buddhism, we don't have that. We don't have a creator God. But then as an experience of God, what is it? And I can only, from my experience, then I say that is the deathless. You know, in terms of the relationship of the conditioned, it's the unconditioned. And then St. John of the Cross refers to God as no-thing. And that's interesting, no-thing, or nothing, or no-thing. Which then people get upset because you're saying, it's like you're saying there isn't any God. But that's not what you're saying. You're saying God isn't a thing. Or you could say, God doesn't exist, and then you say, "You mean there isn't any God?" But existing is, you know, are things. Things exist. You see, so then you're, you know, in contemplating this way, God then is see, if it's truly, you know, pointing to a spiritual realization that is deathless and ultimate, then I have no problem with, say, God or Dhamma or whatever. You know, these are a matter of just words and traditions. But the experience, mystical experience, I can't see how it could be any different. You know, how you might describe it because of if you're Christian and you use Christian terms, it's just a way of talking about something. And a vocabulary and agreed expression that means something to Christians, or Buddhists have their way of it. But the actual, like, you know, it's in mindfulness, we're getting beyond language itself and the conditioned perceptions of the mind, the assumptions and the cultural conditioning of the mind. But I don't know. I mean, as far as the rest of you, this is just from my experience, because now to say Buddhists don't believe in God, or this seems so like such a, you know, it's a misrepresentation. It's putting Buddhism as just some kind of, you know, Buddhists don't believe in God. We don't have that. And Christians believe in God, and but what do you mean by God? And do you know God? Do you know what that really is? Have you really, or do you think the crazy voices in your head is God talking to you? You know, and you can interpret it any way you want, you know, but in terms of experience and. Well, you're getting beyond the convention, because mindfulness is even to transcend Buddhism itself. You know, it's considered the raft you get across. It's only expedient means. It's not something to hold on to. So then, when you realize that, then there's no, you know, you can see that religions are really not in conflict with each other in terms of the true religious of what I would consider the true religious experience. But in terms of the conventions, they can be quite different. You know, they don't have to all be the same or use exactly the same symbols or the same techniques.
I feel a little uncomfortable about saying that. I have experienced God in my practice as a universal energy of immense love and compassion. When I came out of the sitting in which I experienced that, the only word that I could give to this was this is God.
Right, and that is how you would describe it, but in itself it had no name.
It was just such an all-encompassing energy that touched everything.
Yeah.
That, to me, that is what God means.
So then, in terms of this is where, you know, the words themselves then are, you know, they're nothing in themselves. They're just sounds and words. But they're, you know, the function of a word is to direct your attention to something. So if you put God on a low level, like being the, whatever you perceive it, then that's where you tend to put your, you know, you tend to get like that or do those things. So in putting God, the word God, into the transcendent or the unconditioned or the as that which is complete, then you know, that would mean to me that then God is, that would draw your, move you toward that rather than toward God telling you to kill the Prime Minister. But if you're a fanatic, then you create God. You know, these are like what heresy really is, isn't it? Where you just follow your own deluded state of mind. Then I think we've covered it all. Pretty profound stuff. And death, God, sex. Desire, Krishnamurti, Sri Aurobindo. Also recognize that in terms of people in, you know, people who are enlightened may not necessarily understand other religions or all, you know, it doesn't mean that you know everything about everything. So that's why, yeah, you know, it doesn't mean that you know about every religion and the authority on everything. Enlightenment means, you know, it can be, you're enlightened people even in tribal societies and that. It doesn't, they might not know anything about Mozart or Christ or anything, but I mean it's because it's not a matter of you get biased views, you know. So maybe your culture sees Christianity in a certain way or sees Buddhism in a certain way. So and they say, well, Buddhists believe that there isn't any God, and then the enlightened person may say, well, Buddhism is wrong. Because in the terms of the logic, you know, what what they're saying is, you know, they're just going along with what the person, how he perceives Buddhism, or like, I don't know. I mentioned about speaking for other religions because I don't know, like Judaism or Islam or even Christianity. Anything about, say, Christianity is just, I'm not trying to interpret Christianity. But because it has, you know, Christianity has played a part in my life, then it definitely has some kind of, you know, cultural significance in my experience. I mean, there is an interest in it to relate it to my own spiritual experience through Buddhism, through Buddhist practice. But in terms of my own experience, I definitely feel, that it's the Buddhist terms, the Buddhist style that I really know. You know, that's why I would teach Buddha Dhamma. Or, you know, I know how, it's like playing an instrument. You know, if you know how to play the piano, you may not be able to be any good on the violin. You wouldn't know how to teach that, so you teach piano. There's no criticism of violin, is it? So it's not in any way a reflection on that violins are in any way inferior to pianos, but it's merely what you know, what you've used, the instrument that you can play music with. But then a good violinist, a good pianist can make beautiful music. Or they can make terrible music. You know, a bad violinist, bad pianist can, you know, be pretty revolting. It's nothing to do with pianos or violins, is it? It's who the player is. But I find now that, like, even though, you know, conventionally I'm Theravadan Buddhist and all that, that is the convention. But I have there's no attachment to that convention. I mean, what I feel I've learned is how to use the convention as a skillful means. But in regards to other forms of Buddhism, I've gotten a lot from Mahayana, from Prajnaparamita, and various Zen things, and from Advaita Vedanta. And so, well, I mean, it's not that I only know Theravada Buddhism, but I find none of those things conflict with my own experience within the limitation and style of Theravada. Time for the fourth posture.